Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Cinemantics, the podcast about movies good and bad, mostly bad. I am your host, Nick Melton, and my guest host,
Ryan Hauser.
I don't know. You waved at the computer?
I did. I want to wave to all those enjoying the podcast tonight.
Well, thank you. Tonight we have a special treat because this movie is awesome. From 1979 and directed by George Miller, this is
Mad Max.
He's mad.
And he's Max.
That really should have been the tagline for this movie. I don't know what the tagline really is.
I don't know either.
I could check the poster. Yeah, so Mad Max is the story of Mel Gibson. It's actually not the story of Mel Gibson. It's the story of Mel Gibson's
Max.
Character, Max, who was actually not that mad until...
He's actually very sensitive.
Yeah, he's very kind and considerate most of this movie. It's set in Australia, I guess, a few years from now.
Yep.
Post-apocalyptic fantasy. You know, we see a lot of movies like this, you know, set in the barren desert where... The civility is basically broken down. The cops don't look like cops at all. They just wear leather jackets with a badge and drive these really souped-up cars. And their police station is just a dilapidated ruin.
That's also called the Hall of Justice.
With letters falling off the sign. The movie opens on said post-apocalyptic future. There's a guy driving in this car down the highway, and he's clearly, like, just totally wasted on drugs, because he's just, like, laughing hysterically.
Yeah, he's on speed on top of speed. I mean, just out of his mind completely, and he's named Knight Rider.
He calls himself the Knight Rider. We don't know what his name is. Considering all the fuss that they're going to make about him later in the movie, I don't really know why, because he's just crazy.
Now, that's really the only other thing that the bikers say that's sort of, that you can understand is, Knight Rider! Every 3 seconds, I guess, to remember in remembrance of Knight Rider.
What bikers, you might ask? Well, we'll tell you right after this.
Yes, we will.
This, of course, being the continuation of this scene. A bunch of cops get involved in the chase, and the Knight Rider somehow manages to escape them all due to some conveniently placed roadblocks and children running out in the middle of the road and trailers, you know.
Yeah.
There's many, many crashes and loud engine revving and
a lot of motor vehicular antics in the
Knight Rider thinks he's gotten away, and he's just, like, screaming his virtues into the radio. But wait, up ahead.
Which makes no sense.
No, he's on speed. He's got to be. And he's got a very useless girlfriend, useless female, in the car with him.
Who continues to, like, push off him. She'll start to snuggle up against him.
He's very...
deranged?
Yes, he's deranged, but he's... I want to say unresponsive, but that's not the word. Unreceptive?
Unappreciative
of this woman.
Yeah.
They have handcuffs on, so I guess they had to kill a few cops to get away, and they're in this stolen car. But the point is, up ahead, waiting for them, is a man whose face you've never seen, because the camera's been doing some editing to make him look like a badass, so you can't see his face. He's putting on his gloves and putting on sunglasses and just lying in wait. And he takes off after the Knight Rider in pursuit, and evidently freaks him out because he goes from, like, super happy and crazy to all of a sudden basically crying. You remember this? Like, how weird was that?
It was pretty nuts.
Yeah, he's crying.
He had four cops chasing him.
And he's just like, Knight Rider!
Right. Had no problem with the four cops chasing him. As soon as the one guy starts chasing him,
he freaks out and he runs into a truck and explodes his car. So the Knight Rider dies. But then, with a big fanfare trumpet music, out comes Mel Gibson!
Da, da, da.
He is Max, the cop.
And he's mad. Not yet, though.
Not yet. The real cool thing I thought about this movie was that the way it built up to him being Mad Max. I mean, he's only Mad Max for, like, 15 minutes, really? This movie's about an hour and a half?
Yeah, just toward the end of the movie.
So this movie does a really good job setting up the character. I find that a lot of movies from this time period, I mean, the movie that I'm about to reference came from about 5 years before. There's a movie starring Charles Bronson called Death Wish that came out in 1974, which is very, very similar to this film in that he's just a mild-mannered guy. He's not quite as much of a badass slash cop as Mel Gibson is, but, you know, he just lives a normal life and he's a nice man, and then these just total degenerate thugs rape his daughter and murder the wife. And you really can't take the scene too seriously, even though it's disturbingly shot, because one of the thugs is Jeff Goldblum. So it's like, ha, Jeff Goldblum, you're not a rapist. So anyway, Charles Bronson just goes out and starts killing people on a vigilante killing spree. Huh. And it's kind of similar to that. It just sort of takes a long time for it to build. You sort of sense the rage and you get right. to... But what Death Wish does not have is such a cool cast of characters. Like, you were talking about, while we were watching this, just how deranged and colorful all of these characters really were.
Yeah, they were. It's very Fellini-esque, for those who've seen Fellini films. Some of his characters are very mercurial, and I noticed that right away in the movie. And we noticed there's some very odd, like, S&M references or something going on.
Oh, yeah, there's a song that this random woman sings. She's not really an important character, but she mentions motorbikes and leathermen. Huh. And that really should have been the tagline for this film.
Yeah.
Because that's entirely what it is. A lot of car and bike chases and men in leather. I mean,
and I think she was only one of maybe three women we saw.
Three women, yeah. I was commenting on this, and I was... didn't realize we were going to quite get to this part of the discussion so early, but really, it's really got a lot of homoerotic tendencies in there. The men are just decked out in leather, yep. and they're all hanging out together with no women around, and men are in chains, and it's subtle, but you know, especially in today's culture where that sort of stuff is on TV and whatnot, mm-hmm. you know, we're a lot less taboo. Now, than it used to be.
But back then, 1979.
Now, maybe we're reading too much into it, but it was very, very noticeable.
Right.
And there's this part where one of the bikers says, they see a woman, one of the few women, Max's wife, to be exact, and they said, my favorite course, dinner and dessert. And then the other guy says, my favorite kind, female. And it's like, well, that would imply that he likes other kinds too. It's just
exactly.
that females are his favorite. So kind of an interesting, albeit pretty subtle, subversive streak in this movie.
It was. And maybe that helped set the dystopian tone that, I guess at the time, the leather and the bikers and some of the S&M references were kind of maybe taboo. And we noticed the one scene where the guy's just hanging out in his car waiting to chase down Mad Max or the other character. What was his name? Toe Cutter.
The main villain, Toe Cutter. Who's waiting in his car? Max is?
No. One of the villains. He burns himself just randomly, seeing what it would do.
Oh, yes. That was actually not Toe Cutter. That was, I don't know what that character's name is, but he's waiting for,
Some of the characters, they don't really come out and say their names
at
all.
Yeah, if you look at the credit list on IMDb, they all have weird names like Ziggy and Clunk and Mudgets, and they don't say their names at all in the movie except for a few of them, so it's hard to tell who all these people are, but
right. There's
this one guy who's clearly psychopathic, and there's a character who Johnny, that's the dude's name, the dude who burns himself. Max's best friend is named Goose.
Oh, that's who that is.
Of
okay.
course.
Goose.
Played by Steve Bisley. In the beginning of the film, he slides across the pavement, rather painfully looking, on his motorcycle in pursuit of the Knight Rider. And since I didn't see him limping before, I think this is the scene that gave him his limp.
It was, yeah.
But he goes after Johnny, and there's this whole big vendetta between the two of them. So Johnny's like, okay, I'm not going to take that. So he sabotages Goose's motorcycle. And when Goose takes off down the road, we see him in his car waiting for him to leave. And he takes a cigarette lighter and burns his arm for no reason.
Yeah, just completely
random. Other than maybe he has some sort of fetish for pain or whatnot. But it's very strange.
Maybe that says something about those characters in general. They tend to be, like I said before, kind of very mercurial. They enjoy pain and dealing out pain, so that seems to be one of the big themes in this movie. I mean, a lot of things they do that are mean are just completely random, for the most part.
Yeah, they randomly pull this car over to the side of the road, and they just trash that car.
Right.
Like, they basically rip it to pieces, and I don't know what they do to the man and woman inside the car, because there's this loud, crazy music, and then it cuts to this crow in extreme close-up.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's supposed to be symbolism for something?
I don't know what that is.
Before we get too far, I mean, this has basically been a random rambling of observations now.
Mm-hmm.
So we might as well just go down the cast so that people know who we're talking about.
Oh, of course.
Of course, we have Mel Gibson as Max. We have as Jesse, his wife, Joanne Samuel. We have Hugh Keyes Byrne as Toe Cutter, who is the main villain of the piece and the leader of the biker gang.
Right.
Steve Bisley, as we mentioned, is Goose. Tim Burns as Johnny the Boy. Roger Ward as Fifi. Not quite sure who that is. we have Vincent Gill as Knight Rider, who is, you know, fairly memorable, even though he's only in one scene.
That's a pretty big scene, then.
Yeah, it is a pretty big scene. Geoff Perry as Bubba, who is the sort of stoic second-in-command of Toe Cutter.
Yeah, he's sort of that silent, strong type.
Yeah, you can tell there's sort of a craziness boiling underneath the surface.
And sometimes he seems like he's more controlled than the actual leader of the group.
Yeah, and then there is Paul Johnstone as Condolini, who has a rather unfortunate accident later in the film. So yeah, we talked about how the Knight Rider got taken down. Needless to say, this does not bode well with the biker gang, who somehow find his death to be an affront to their gang, and I guess to their whole way of life.
Mm-hmm.
So they go on this rampage basically to get revenge against everybody who is responsible for the death of the Knight Rider, this of course being Jim Goose and Max. Well, they succeed. I think it goes without saying, I mean, this movie has been out for 20 years. This is the 20-year anniversary, basically. So, spoiler bomb dropped. They get away with it. They basically reduce Goose, it rhymes, to a flaming, burned, charred half a person.
It's a roasted goose bed. After that.
Roasted goose. They cook the goose. And they chase down Max and his family and terrorize them. And they finally end up running down Jesse and his toddler in the road.
They even kill the dog, yes.
They even kill the dog, and Max is just, he is not like that.
Yep.
So he goes and systematically proceeds to kill the bikers one by one in badass ways.
And he does get them. And that's really a turning point for him, too. Up until that, I mean, they were even pursuing them for a while, and he kind of put it off. You know, they called the sheriff, or whoever it was, a police officer at one time, and they still kind of just let it slide. But after that point, that's when he becomes Mad Max.
Yeah, he becomes Mad Max. He's going to get some revenge, I tell you. Now that we've given away the entire story within the first 15 minutes, let's talk about the events between the big plot points.
Okay.
Because we just told you all the big plot points.
Sure.
There's the scene at the very beginning where you're supposed to sort of get to know Max and Jesse. They're having coffee or whatnot, and she's grumpy because he has to go to the station, so he puts on this mask, and he's like, oh, are you grumpy?
Right.
And when he's leaving, she sign languages him, I'm crazy about you. I don't know why.
And we're not sure if he knew. Well, he didn't know what it meant,
because she had to explain it to him. So evidently she knows sign language, and he's never encountered this sign language before. But
and the mask was significant, too. That came up again at the end of the movie.
I really liked that, the way that they took these little details and brought them back at various points throughout the movie. They don't give you a million scenes of Max and Jesse, you know, being all snuggly-snuggly, because they only need these little details to bring up a few times to show that they have a bond, a connection. Later in the movie, when he's trying to fix the car, there's that moment where she's like, oh, don't touch me with those grease monkey hands, but it's very flirtatious, very charming and cute.
Right.
And
you can tell they have a pretty large backstory with
he's behind the scenes learned how to sign it back to her, and so there's little things like that. So they have a relationship, clearly. So I liked that. Is there anything that immediately springs to mind for you that you want to talk about?
I mean, I didn't see a lot of other things. I'm kind of like you. There was a lot of little subtle details. You mentioned, and I completely missed it the first time. There's a point in the movie where they're first getting away from the biker gang, and a guy tries to lasso their car with a chain. And we don't really see what happens, but he falls down behind the car. You know, he clearly was unsuccessful in his attempt to lasso it. Well, later on, you see the car pulling up, and Nick, you noticed that the hand was still kind of attached to the chain. His hand had come off.
I was watching him for it this time, because it comes as sort of a shock.
Right, but completely missed it. I thought that was kind of nice and a little slow.
Yeah, they do pay attention to continuity in this movie, which is sort of unusual for an action movie.
It is.
By the way, what a great action movie this is. I mean, it has some very nice, it's basically entirely car chases. There's no fist fights, there's no gun battles, there's no aerial fights. It's all car chases. And George Miller, the director, did a really good job with the car chases.
Right. As a matter of fact, I think there's only two times that someone shot in the movie. Is that right? And it's just at the end, that one scene.
I think there's sort of an implied No, it isn't. Never mind. Because I was going to say there's that weird scene where they bring the biker gang brings the mannequin to the beach and they're like fondling the mannequin, furthering the notion that they don't have much interaction with females because they're trying to get it on with a mannequin. And Johnny the boy shoots the mannequin with a shotgun, and Toe Cutter somehow gets really upset by this, and he like shoves the shotgun in Johnny's mouth and tells him to keep his sweet, sweet mouth shut.
Yeah.
And then they randomly walk off into the water together. But since Johnny, the first time I saw it, I was like, oh my god, he's going to drown him. But it fades out, and that character's later in the movie, so
right.
I don't know what that's supposed to imply.
I'm not sure either. I think there are some implied homoerotic, you know, stuff in the film. We talked about that, or, you know. It's interesting. I don't know. It kind of implies certain things, but it's never really explicit. You could probably read whatever you want to and into
parts
of the movie.
I kind of like that they don't feel the need to explain anything in this movie.
It's very Freudian.
They don't tell you how we got to this barren future.
No.
That we don't tell you why the police department is so dilapidated.
Mm-hmm.
Why law hasn't broken down, but basically it has. Why all this weird, like, uniform changes? Why people just let these random bikers terrorize everybody on the road? You know, why is there anything? When I noticed this time when he goes to the mechanic to get his flat tire fixed, there's a sign on the mechanic's shop that says, bring your own tools.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they don't have their own tools? Like,
I missed that, actually.
Yeah, well, it's a very small detail, but, you know, everything just sort of helps paint a larger portrait. And George Miller was very smart and filmed basically the entire thing in the vast Australian outback. Very few hills. It's very grassy, very just plains as far as the eye can see.
Mm-hmm.
So you get this feeling of barren nothingness.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's nothing in the world anymore except these little rural communities and these little towns.
Mm-hmm.
And then these vast expanses between them that are basically lawless and populated by ruthless biker gangs.
Right. I think that does that to it. And you're right. Every town we see, or every, you know, community, or if you can call it a community, it seems very deserted. I mean, even some of the large ones, there are only like
two people in each town.
Yeah.
The only characters in the film really are ones that serve to get terrorized by the biker gang.
Right.
What did you think of the biker gang there? They were very strange characters, and Toe Cutter in particular was just very bizarre. I mean, he would like hiss at Max, you know, the thing that we were talking about.
Well, they were the oddest, you know,
they weren't really that scary, but they were so unhinged that you never knew what they were going to do. Like,
they were very unhinged. There was a lot of, like we said, implied like sexual references and what they were doing. It also never gives any good clues as to why they are the way they are, any real backstory to them.
They're just sort of... I think what's great about this is that the backstories don't... the backstories are less important because the performances are so good.
They are.
Like, these actors inhabit these characters, and Hugh Keyes Byrne in particularly does a really good job, because his Toe Cutter is just... It's very convincing. He's kind of frightening in how loose and psychotic he is. You don't need a backstory. All you know is that this is the embodiment of crazy.
Right.
And how he got crazy is sort of irrelevant. All you know is that here and now, in the present, they have to fight this pretty malevolent force.
And I guess that's true for a lot of successful movies that have had that same type of character or characters. We've seen it even in movies recently with the Joker from the Batman movie.
The Dark Knight.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So, I mean, that's a prevalent thing in a lot of movies. I mean, for me personally, I would like to see maybe a little bit more backstory. But you're right, they were just sort of this driving force of evil and craziness in the movie. And honestly, even as dystopian as the society seemed, it seemed like these bikers were really the craziest part of the society. The other citizens seemed fairly normal.
You notice that there's not much reference to what people do for entertainment. There's the one scene where Goose goes to the cabaret and watches that woman sing the song about motorbikes and Leathermen.
Right.
And he clearly sleeps with her because we see her in his bed the previous morning when he leaves. But there's no one in that bar.
No, I mean, not at all.
You know, so it, just these little things that happen. The vast landscapes with these really tiny populations.
Mm-hmm.
You got to wonder what it was that happened. So I think that they did a really cool job with this.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see here. Is there anything interesting in here? Oh yeah, we need to talk about this. Mel Gibson. This was made back in 1979, well before Lethal Weapon.
Oh, yeah.
Well before any of his current anti-Semitic accusations or Passion of the Christ or any of that, Ransom, any of that. So what did you think of Mel Gibson? I mean, with this early in his career when no one knew anything about him, like, did that, I mean, knowing what was coming, did that sort of color the opinions of it, or was it just sort of, you know, you bought it?
It did, maybe to an extent, but I mean, I really bought into his character. I thought he did a pretty good job. You know, his character is very subtle in a way. We talked about it. You know, they start to develop a little bit of a backstory and some information. You know, through some hints about how much history he and his girlfriend, you know, have, but yet they don't really implicitly ever come out and explain it. We know that, of course, he works for the police department. It's apparently pretty feared. Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was a pretty strong performance, particularly if that's his first performance.
Yeah, it says here on the Wikipedia page that Mel Gibson was a complete unknown at this point. He went into auditions with his friend and classmate Steve Bisley, who would later land the part of Goose. Gibson went to the auditions in poor shape, as the night before he had gotten into a drunken brawl with three men at a party, resulting in a swollen nose, a broken jawline, and various other bruises. That doesn't really surprise me, given Mel Gibson's current
activities. We'll
Mel showed up at the audition the next day looking like a quote-unquote black and blue pumpkin and didn't expect to get the part. He only went to accompany Bisley. However, the casting agent liked the look and told him to come back in 2 weeks, telling him, "We need freaks." When Gibson returned, he was not recognized because his wounds had healed almost completely, but he received the part anyway.
Right.
And he is surprisingly empathetic. I was commenting during the movie, you know, for an action hero, he likes to talk about his feelings a lot.
Right.
You know, there's this long scene where he's laying there, you know, in the sun with the wife, and she's just sort of laying on top of him, you know, caressing him with her fingers, you know, the way that women do in movies like this. And he's talking about this story about his dad and his dad's shoes and how proud he was of his dad. And, you know, how often do you see, you know, these little developing scenes with action heroes in this day and age? They've all got to be stoic and silent.
Right.
You know, I think the last one who was actually any sort of a wisecrack or anything at all was like John McClane in the Die Hard movies.
Right.
I don't know how big you are into action movies.
But I think that worked pretty well because, like you said, most action figures, you see them being very stoic. Well, here we have Mel Gibson. I think it helps endear the character to you. You know, you get to know a little bit about him, and you realize he's not a Mad Max per se. He's just a normal guy.
Who's driven to the breaking point.
Right. And that helps you kind of relate to his frustration after his, you know, family is destroyed by these bikers who are pretty much just crazy. I mean, they have no rhyme and reason to most of the things they do. But
Speaking of his family, though, I really liked the grandma. The gun-toting grandma, she's just like, she's not going to take any business from anybody. She's going to pop a cap in your ass if you get in her way.
And she just about saved him.
Yeah.
Very close.
Yeah. Not that it does any good in the end. But,
no.
Yeah. Speaking of cars and car chases, since we were talking about it, why don't we go over the vehicles real quick?
Sure.
This is probably of more interest to automotive fans, whatever automotive fans out there might be listening. But the original car that he's driving at the beginning of the movie, his police car, was a 1974 Ford Falcon XB sedan, which had previously been used as a police car in Melbourne, with a 350 CI Cleveland V8 engine and many other modifications. But the big car, the car that everybody cares about, is the black car at the end that Max uses for his revenge. It's called the Pursuit Special, called in the movie as the last of the V8 Interceptors. That was a limited GT351 version of a 1973 Ford XB Falcon hardtop, which was primarily modified by Murray Smith, Peter Arquettepain, and Ray Beckerly. After the first movie was completed, the car was handed over to Murray Smith, and when the production of Mad Max 2, known in the U.S. as The Road Warrior, began, the car was again purchased back by George Miller for use in the sequel. Once filming was over, the car was left at a wrecking yard and was bought and restored by Bob Forsenko and is currently on display in the Cars of the Stars Motor Museum in Cumbria, England. That's a pretty badass car, too.
It is pretty interesting.
I love it. It's got, like, a big modified engine on the hood of the car.
Yeah, I mean, the cars in the film and the bikes, too, are almost, like, characters in the film. And there's, you know, like we were saying earlier, a lot of action. It basically revolves around car chases and car crashes. I don't believe I've seen that many car crashes since Blues Brothers. You remember, the cars are always crashing.
And I really liked how not everything had to explode in this movie.
No, not at all. Even when Goose gets burnt, there was no explosion, really.
It's just a wall of fire.
Right.
But, I mean, the only car that explodes, I think, in the entire movie, although I could be mistaken, is the Knight Rider's car. Yeah. At the very beginning, he crashes into the truck, and the car blows up. I don't remember a single other car blowing up in this movie.
Johnny's car? Oh, well, the car that Johnny... At the end of the movie, Johnny's pulling the boots off some
of a guy whose car he evidently trashed.
Right, exactly. Whatnot. And he... Max basically ties Johnny to the car and forces him to light the car on fire, igniting the fuel.
Max sets up a timer, basically. He's noticing that the car is leaking gas, and we find this particularly ironic since Goose used this same... Goose had this method used against him earlier.
Right,
thus reducing him to thus reducing him to a burning wreck. So Mel Gibson is like, I can use this to my advantage. So he plants a cigarette lighter on top of what I guess is going to be a fuse, and he handcuffs the dude to the car, and the guy basically only has a few minutes left before the car is going to blow. And he says that the handcuff that is connecting you to the car is made of this really tough steel, and it'll take you 10 minutes to cut through it with this hacksaw. Mm-hmm. If you're lucky, you can cut through your ankle in 5. And then he throws it at him and walks away.
Right.
It's so
great scene.
It's
great
so
scene.
Badass. And we don't really see the car explode. We see Max driving away, and then a big ball of fire rising up in the background.
And you have to wait for it, too. You know it's coming. At one point, I kind of doubted it, because the scene where he's driving away took so long.
It's great. I love it. There's a great sense of timing in this movie. The scene where his wife is down at the beach with the dog, and she's laying in the sun. Every second she was down there, I expected her to get attacked by those bikers.
Oh, yeah.
She gets up. She looks around. The dog is gone. There's silence, except for, you know, the sound of the waves. And then she leaves, and you're like, oh, is she okay after all? Oh, no. There are figures in the woods.
Right.
You know, and she's running through the woods, and there are figures chasing her, but you can't really see who they are. And then, oh, again, another big false alarm. They're there, but they don't get her. And I really like that George Miller plays with audience expectations like that.
Oh, yeah.
By doing a scene like that where... It's basically a big fake-out, cop-out, whatever, but it's a really well-done fake-out because it actually shows you by looking at the bikers in the woods that the threat is there. It's just it resolves in a different way than you expect.
And even some of the bigger crashes and explosions, like we're talking, there weren't really a lot of cars that exploded, but he saves them for the bigger plot points in the movie, like at the end when Johnny's car explodes, and in the beginning when Knight Rider's car explodes. So I think that's one of these things.
Yeah, that you've just made me think of something about the symmetry of this movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, the movie as itself isn't very symmetrical, but there are moments that are symmetrical. Mm-hmm. The Knight Rider at the beginning, there's a very memorable shot. It's very quick, very edited in there, where you see his eyes bulge tremendously before his car hits the truck.
Oh, right.
At the end of the movie...
Happens again.
At the end of the movie, the tow cutter is being chased by Max on the road, and Max is really catching up to him in his car, and for once, just like the Knight Rider, this big, arrogant, insane guy... is reduced to worry, and we can't really see him cry through his helmet, but we can pretty much assume that he will at any moment, because Max is just relentless. And all of a sudden, this truck is driving down the road, and he sees the truck too late. And right before he hits the truck, there are not one, but two big shots of his eyes bulging almost completely out of his head. It couldn't have been a real person. It had to have been like a dummy that they filmed the eyes really bulging. And then he just gets slammed by the truck, and it's great.
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff in this movie, I noticed, was gruesome without being really gory or overly gruesome.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of blood.
I didn't really notice any blood, except for,
when Max gets shot
here and there. When Max gets shot, that's the most gory shot in the movie, where they shoot him in the knee. By the way, Mel Gibson is a total badass, because they shoot him in the knee, and they run over his arm with a motorcycle, and he still gets up and shoots Bubba in the face as he's driving towards him on his motorcycle, manages to chase the tow cutter into an oncoming truck, and then blows up Johnny with a car bomb.
Right.
How badass! I love it. I love this movie. It is so great. And I love it because it will appeal to genre fans. It's not attempting to be Fellini, even though, as you noted, it has sort of perhaps an unintentional Fellini-esque-ness to it.
I think it's just because the performances from the characters is so good.
It's just a really, really well-made genre film.
Mm-hmm.
The performances are really good. The stunts are really good. It's a genuinely exciting movie, and they actually care about their characters. There's that scene where... Goose has his bike messed up, so he goes flying off the bike, and then he gets in the car, to drive his bike to the tow truck, and then Johnny throws, like, this big metal disc through the windshield,
yep.
thus causing him to run the truck off the road, and it flips over. The tow cutter just sort of pops out of nowhere, and he's like, here, take this match and light the truck on fire. And Johnny's like, no, man, this isn't what I signed up for. I don't want
to
do that.
And that's another one of those moments when we get a little bit more backstory, because we begin to see that Johnny is probably a newer member of the group, you know, going through phases of initiation. And yeah, he refuses to light the car at first, even though at this point he's done what all to him? He's wrecked his bike.
He's wrecked his car, but he hasn't killed him. I think... Yeah. At this point, he's been so accustomed to just, you know, roughing up people and maybe, you know, smashing some windshields. You know, there's not been death involved. It's just been, you know, we'll hurt him, but we're not going to kill him. So I really like that even the craziest of characters, except maybe for Toe Cutter, has these moments of humanity that glimpse through. Mm-hmm. And I really like that. Even though the characters in this movie inhabit a very barren landscape, I also really liked how there are characters who take their job really seriously. There's the police chief. He's always going on speeches about how people don't believe in heroes anymore, and we need our heroes back.
Right.
And you know, and then there's Goose, who's really, really committed to the job. When Johnny gets released from custody because they couldn't find any witnesses to testify against him, presumably because they're also terrified of this gang.
Right.
And they have to let Johnny go, and Goose is like, no, he basically, like, gets in a fight with the entire police station trying to get to Goose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really... Not to Goose, to Johnny.
To Johnny.
They all have such weird names. But, you know, it's a lot of moments like that. It's just great. I love it.
Yeah.
They make every character convincing, I think.
I agree.
So anything else you want to say about Mad Max? Anything that came to mind? Or
I think that's it, really. I mean, it's not your typical action film. There's a lot of good action, but it's subdued. To an extent, I think they only use, you know, big explosions or really dramatic stuff in the bigger plot points in the movie. So I like the way they try to save a lot of the action for some of the bigger moments. You know, they don't overuse it. The characters are really developed. You know, even some of the criminals who we don't know that well. You know, like Johnny with that one scene we were just talking about. Yeah, I don't know. It's just a really good movie.
Yes. Before we go on to some other things, I'm just scrolling at the trivia here on the IMDb page. While I go on my nice little rant, perhaps you'd like to look
sure.
and see if you see anything that looks really interesting. Sure. What I wanted to talk about was the music. And feel free to pipe in about this, because we were both talking
sure.
about
oh,
this.
Oh, yeah, I can't believe we haven't mentioned
movie.
It yet.
The music is by a guy named Brian May, and unfortunately, it's not the Brian May from Queen. He provides this really big, over-the-top, bombastic orchestral score that in many ways seems really like it's too much. I mean, what did you think? Because you were just talking about the action being kind of subdued, so why would they go so over the top with the music like this, do you think?
Well, it's probably the only thing that was over the top, and it really did set up a lot of the scenes really well. I'm not sure what they were going for, really. We talked about that the whole time, about what they were trying to use the music for. It was all instrumental, very over-exaggerated, you know. It's almost something you would see out of a crummy TV show. What do you think about the music?
Oh, I loved it. I think that a lot of people are going to say, oh, it's so blatantly over the top, it's just huge and in your face. But I think that gives the movie a sort of charm.
Mm-hmm.
The story is preposterous.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's relatable. We can relate to Max's rage. But, I mean, really? They're in the post-apocalyptic future with biker gangs and car explosions. Come on.
Yeah.
If you can accept that, you can accept some over-the-top music.
Yeah.
And I thought that it just lended a very good, very sort of charming, in a way, air to the mood of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you need a big, dramatic gesture.
Mm-hmm.
But what I really liked also is that there's not a lot of music during the car chases and other such things. It's very... There's a lot of silence during these extended car chases, except maybe for the big dramatic moments at the end of the car chases. So that's what I got to say about that. But looking at this trivia, Hugh Keyes Byrne, Tim Burns, and Reg Evans, a.k.a. Toe Cutter, Johnny the Boy, and the Station Master, were all classically trained Shakespearean stage actors. So that would explain why they're all so good in this movie. They are actually real-world trained actors.
Oh, I thought this was interesting. And we saw this at one point in the movie, and I'm not sure why they left it in, but it was very interesting. At one point, Max and his partner Goose are parked, and Goose is talking to, like, a couple that just got off their motorcycle, and he says, here's your get-out-of-free-jail card. Well, we were just scanning IMDb, and it says that Goose, you know, gives him the get-out-of-jail-free card, which was a on-set joke. Apparently, the budget was so limited that an actual biker gang was used for the biker gang in the set. And each day they rode to set on, you know, in costume with their prop weapons displayed. And since the production company expected them at any time to get pulled over by the police, each was given a letter just explaining the film's peculiar requirements and asking for the law enforcement to you know, be understanding and cooperate. So yeah, that kind of explains that scene.
That's kind of cool. Yeah. That helps with the air of authenticity too.
Right.
The biker gang looks like a biker gang. The very strangely behaved biker gang. I mean, a couple of them tango out in the street and
that was very odd.
Sing to each other. It's very strange. It says here that the Knight Rider's spectacular crash was the result of a military booster rocket being installed in the back of the car. It went out of control, missed the target fuel tanker, and veered off into the field where it chased the film crew for a quarter of a mile. The on-camera explosion was a later recreation using a safer towed car.
Oh.
That's pretty badass.
That is pretty interesting.
Wow, there's a lot of trivia for this. The entire film soundtrack had to be redubbed afterwards, as well as the voices of all the cast. This has been rectified in recent years. I'm not quite sure what they mean by that.
Huh.
This is not so much trivia. This is just probably something somebody added for funnies. It is ironic that there's a character called Knight Rider in the film, and a car that Max drives at the end looks similar to Kit, the car from Knight Rider.
Yeah, I kind of noticed that too, actually. Yeah.
Oh, I've never actually seen Knight Rider, but do you think that was a deliberate thing or just kind of coincidence? I mean, this is an Australian film. I don't know how big of a...
Well, Knight Rider, I believe, was a little bit further after that. It says Knight Rider's 1982, so it could be very well that maybe Knight Rider, you know,
was influenced by this.
Right, which would be amazing to...
It says here that the wife, Joanne Samuel, was a last-minute replacement for an actress who was injured in a motorcycle accident 4 days before filming began. That is pretty cool. Hugh Keyes Byrne modeled his performance of Toe Cutter after historical records written about Mongolian warlord Temujin, also known as Genghis Khan.
Oh, interesting, interesting.
And he does have a very larger-than-life air of authority about him. The bikers just, you know, they bow to his every whim.
They do.
But before, you know, we just read this, you know, every single one of these, because, you know, it is interesting, I'll just say that if you're intrigued by what we've been saying, just go to the IMDb page and read some of the trivia, because there's a lot of car trivia on here, whatnot, a lot of budget stuff. The blue van that was wrecked in the film's opening chase had the engine removed and was pushed into the path of the oncoming cars by off-camera assistance. The lack of the engine's weight caused the van to spin uncontrollably, adding to the spectacular crash.
Right.
Yeah, the beginning is very, very cool, and the ending is also spectacular. The auto accident scene was made as realistic as possible thanks to director George Miller's experience as a medical doctor.
Huh.
So that's pretty cool. But anyway, final thoughts on Mad Max?
Great movie. I mean, I definitely suggest people to go out and see it. I mean, I'm not a big action genre fan, but I mean, I really enjoyed the movie. I thought it was very well done. I'm kind of surprised that the budget was as small as it was. I mean, it definitely is not a big budget film. You can tell that right away, but they did very well, apparently, with what they had.
Oh, yeah. And just from a critical standpoint, the second film, The Road Warrior, as it's known here in the U.S., is actually considered a much better film, because with this sort of origin story out of the way, it's a few years later, Max is like just totally this nihilistic character roaming the desert. It's a very bleak existential film, and yet it apparently ups the ante of the action to even greater heights, and we will be covering that movie at some point on this podcast.
Okay.
So I'm looking forward to that. As for my final thoughts, I'm going to have to agree with you. I love this movie. It's really entertaining. It's not too long. The characters are all really well developed. Without a lot of tedious exposition. It's all in little body language and
they're very
gestures.
Efficient with what they do.
Yeah, very well written, very well acted, just great, great classic action film. So that's all I got to say about that. Anyway, you have been listening to Cinemantics, the podcast about movies good and bad, mostly bad, or in this case, awesome.
Awesome.
I am Nick Melton.
Ryan Hauser.
And catch you folks next time.